This conference will now be recorded.
Okay, everyone, this is Danny again from the State Medical Association. We really appreciate you all getting on this call on a Friday evening. Dr. Clay Marsh, who is the COVID-19 czar in West Virginia, as well as Dean of Health Sciences at WVU, and Dr. Kathy Slimp, the State Health Officer and Commissioner of the Bureau of Public Health, are going to give you a little bit of update and give you a chance to take questions. Right now, we've muted everyone. So you won't be able to talk or interrupt the call because there's a lot of people that are on there and even more we plan to get on. So if you have questions, we ask that you submit them through the chat function. If you're talking on the phone, we ask that you submit them to info@wvsma.org and we'll get those questions to make sure that they're asked. This meeting will be recorded and posted on the WVSMA website for anybody to listen to at a later date or to pass on to your other colleagues. So I don't believe Dr. Marsh has gotten on yet, but I do see that Dr. Slimp is there.
You bet. Thanks, Danny. It's great to be here. First, I just want to say thank you to the State Medical Association for hosting these. It's been a great opportunity, I'm finding, to really kind of connect here with folks on the ground, share information as it evolves with you, and really more importantly, have opportunity to dialogue around issues. So first, thank you to State Medical for hosting these and for everyone who's joining us. We're increasingly each time having more and more folks join. So thank you for joining us. And then also just for the work that you're doing every day. I know this is a challenging time, is a concerning time. We are kind of watching and seeing what's happening and trying to do everything we can to prevent disease spread and minimize risk to the burden on the healthcare system, at the same time really planning ahead in terms of how would we handle that when and if that occurs. I believe, as Danny said, that we are recording these, and they are going on the website, both the State Medical Association website and the coronavirus website at the state, which is coronavirus.wvb.gov as the main page there. I'm excited today to host it with Dr. Marsh. We've had an active day here, and we've been on the phone, he and I, myself, for several times today on some issues, and we can talk about some of those shortly. But he's going to be joining us as soon as he can to come back online with us. I'll just highlight a couple of things that have been kind of going on or that are new, and then we'll hear Dr. Marsh when he comes on, and then we can open up questions. So a couple of new things on the coronavirus.wv.gov website. There is a new dashboard that got launched today. So it actually has more information about the cases that we've had so far, and of the so that the cases and the testing data and that kind of thing. You can actually it's more interactive at this point. So from the dashboard, you can click on the number of cases and you get more information on the cases by county. So you can see what's happening in your own community more. You can look at the gender breakdown and the age distribution of our cases. We are seeing the majority of our cases being in individuals 60 and above. Adults and then up into the elderly population are really where we're seeing those cases. We are unfortunately beginning to see deaths. We have had two, and this is an increasing area that I expect we will see more, as shortly, sadly, because we are seeing that, for the most part, it's our very elderly and frail, that are dying from this, so far. Now, again, we've just had a few in West Virginia, but we see that is mirrored nationally. The ones we've had previously have been in their 80s and lots of other underlying chronic disease. The other one area I might highlight briefly of something that has been emerging and evolving, and it relates to the PPE issue. We can speak more about PPE as we get into the questions, and I can share more about what's underway with that. But they're also today, I think it was launched an ECHO effort on personal protective equipment. We had over 200 people joining, and so that has really been, I think it was a nice description of when to use PPE and donning and doffing and a host of other kind of reminders about PPE. And so I think that's going to be an ongoing series. Is that right, Lisa? It's every Thursday at 12:15. There will be an echo related to that topic. So that will be again next week. Is that right?
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday that will repeat. So we can get information out on that if people want to know how to link into that. We will anticipate doing other town halls over time on different topics. And so again, we always want to collect your thoughts on what those should be as we go forward. Otherwise, the last thing I want to do is just do a little bit for folks that are joining new or have not been with us, some of these other ones, kind of give you an update on the bigger picture, broader kind of where we are, what the current projections are for West Virginia and some of the models, and what we might anticipate moving forward. So just to briefly do that, as you know, coronavirus, we've always been thinking about it mostly from an angle of respiratory droplet spread, and that is critical and the primary means of transmission most likely. Certainly can have transmission from environmental surfaces and then putting our hands in our mouth or our nose, those kind of areas. But one of the things that I think has been evolving and becoming clearer and clearer most recently, although we've suspected this for some time, is that there's a potential for either pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission. That viral levels can be pretty high right before someone gets sick, before they develop symptoms, and right along those early days of infection is when our illness, when our viral loads are highest, and so then that tapers off over time. And so that kind of is beginning to shape more fully how we do our contact investigations. We're moving earlier in those exposures with folks and making us really think about how we do prevention measures and the importance of the prevention measures that we do. So you're seeing things like from the PPE standpoint, CDC is starting to talk more about using masks more routinely in among population. Not the face masks, those are the ones we need to keep for the healthcare system, but some of these other community or homemade masks or other settings for twofold. One, it certainly can help people stop putting their hands on their face, but equally if they are having asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic spread, maybe it will actually help block a little bit of that is the other thought with that. But I think on the bigger picture, what that really begins to make us think is about with that asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission potential is the importance of those physical distancing and community mitigation measures, that really is the strength of what we've got to really dampen that curve and slow down transmission so that the impact on the healthcare system and on the health of our population and on our economy longer term is lower. And so I think that these recent studies really just speak to the importance of that work and the fact that we really need to not rely simply on testing data or case data to manage this disease, but to really continue to do that physical distancing, social distancing, or actually physical distancing, social connectedness still is important, but that physical distancing, that environmental cleaning, that good hand washing, and that really is what makes a difference there. But that is how we will really make a big impact. Similarly, in the clinical arena, how do we think about treating presumptively, especially as we start to see things spreading more in the community at a higher level, that we really treat presumptively and manage folks at the level of care where they can best, where they're needing that clinically. So the majority of folks still will have disease that they can manage at home. But really our role as clinicians in supporting them in managing at home and having them staying at home. And then how do we think about managing their close family members, et cetera, to prevent further spread. If you look at the projection, there are some interesting projections, and I think I've referenced these before. They're out of something called the, I think it's the Institute for Health Management. Like, I don't have the exact name, but there's a interesting model that most of this nation has been using out of University of Washington to look at their own projections moving forward. And so currently they are projecting, based on our current data, that West Virginia would, the peak of our clinical impact would be around the beginning of May, around the 4th of May. I think every day it changes as we do a better job keeping low rates. It actually pushes out a little further than what we want. But that projection is that it would be around the beginning of May, around the 4th of May. Interestingly, it also looks at projections of ventilator use and beds and ICU beds. And it currently looks like we would be fairly good along those lines, be able to meet most of that capacity. But we are not sitting by thinking that's what we want to, we hope that's what happens. But we really want to make sure, we know that things can change rapidly. And so there's a lot of planning around how to really expand that surge and deal with that issue. I use all that to just say, as much as we can do as clinicians to really help people know and understand and operationalize effectively the physical distancing and the use of the healthcare system, and the follow-up and duration of staying home, the better we are long-term. Let us stop there and see if Dr. Marsh is on by chance.
Okay. There was a question that came in that I think speaks to what Dr. Slemp was just touching on, and maybe she could just further answer this question, that the CDC cumulative index data shows West Virginia at or very near the bottom in terms of population rates per 100,000. Is that due to good planning, good luck, rapid implementation of social distancing, or what?
Great question. You are correct. We look around the country at the, what we're all following is the percent positivity of some of our testing. And we're looking at a cumulative percent positivity. We have been running in West Virginia around 4% or so the last several days, and holding fairly steady with that as a cumulative across the state number. Most of our surrounding states are at the 7, 8, 9%. I think the average around the country was about 17 last I looked at. And you look at New York and New Jersey, where they are really struggling, and they are looking at 30, 40%, 50% sometimes. So we are in a handful of states that probably the this is one of those areas we like to have this. We usually think West Virginia we're not doing as well. We're actually doing better in this. Probably the bottom four or five states that have low rates with that. So what is that due to? Probably multifactorial. We don't have as much travel, I think, as much as some jurisdictions. So we don't have quite as much, didn't have as much international travel to start with, as much people are not coming in and out as much as some other locations. We are more spread out. We've got more geographic distance between us. People tend to stay in a community. So we have some of those factors, our rural nature, our kind of movement dynamics kinds of things are probably to our benefit with that. And then the other side, I think, is we did start doing that physical distancing and that social distancing. We call it social distancing in the literature, but reality is we think about it as it's really physical distancing. And I'm trying to help people shift that to that physical distancing because we want to make sure the social connections are still there. But that physical distancing and that environmental hygiene kind of things, we did begin that before we ever had our first cases. And there is a increasing body of literature that is saying that if you implement those early, and if you can do them effectively, and that they can really have a big impact. And if people are not doing distant travel, there was an interesting public article recently that if you're within a mile or two of where you kind of circulate versus, 10 or 15 miles, you get a lot less spread in a community. And so I think we did implement that stuff early, which I think has probably helped us make a big difference. the experience, if you look around the country, is that, and around the world, if you can do that in a way that engages people and maximizes their voluntary implementation of those principles, it is actually much more effective than if you do it under a lockdown kind of setting. And so it really is more effective on a voluntary basis with that. And so if you can get people up to, you know, at least 75, 80% of folks really, really closely following that, you can make a big impact. If you get it to 90%, you can make it even further. So that's the principles of that. And so I think back to the question, it really is that combination of things probably. I will say, some of you may have heard about this today, we are seeing a lot of increased transmission in the Eastern Panhandle. And that is really beginning to pick up significantly. And that's kind of not surprising for that region. There's a lot more intersection with large population centers, a lot more travel back and forth. It's happening not just in Berkeley County per se, but in the surrounding counties in Maryland and Pennsylvania as well. So I think that is an area that we're suddenly seeing some increasing transmission, which again, we would not be surprised that being the case because of the kinds of movements that occurs in that part of the state.
So I think Dr. Marsh is finishing up with a call with the governor. And so Dr. Bill Ramsey has been helping Dr. Marsh here and Dr. Slemp. And I think he's joined us and can speak maybe a little bit as Dr. Marsh is finishing up and going to join us in a bit.
Hi, Bill.
Get unmuted there. Hi, everybody. Bill Ramsey here. Thanks, y'all. Clay should be along shortly. Of course, Kathy and I have worked together for years, so she's the public health person. From a systems perspective, and some of the things that I've been helping Clay and others with is just to have people understand that we have a very large team. This is like nothing that we've seen before, as many of you know. So we have lots of moving parts to this. Certainly the exceptional work by DHHR and Kathy and Secretary Crouch, but there's many, many other pieces of this that are going on that I think it's important to be aware of. You know, we have great support from our National Guard. They're doing a lot of great things moving around in coordination with the health effort. We have a lot of research going on about alternative PPE. We've also done a pretty good job of stocking up on that as we move forward. And as Kathy said, one of the keys besides our other isolation, rural issues, which usually is a disadvantage of us, but which is probably an advantage this time, is really, the leadership made decision to really move to this personal physical distancing and these other measures before we even had a single case. That's really important. And you can see that show out not only in the literature, but some of the hot spots. The other thing that we're working on right now as a system-wide approach is our surge capacity, how we do if that surge hits us where it is, how we would handle that. We have a significant amount of fluff that has been built in because many of our hospitals have dropped their censuses. So the first approach to that, rather than trying to set up too many alternate facilities, and certainly Kathy, if I say something that's off kilter here, help me, but we really look at that surge capacity that we can do within our existing facilities. And that's obviously the best way to do it if you can, because you have the people there, you have the personnel there, in many cases you have the testing there, and you can do that in a more organized manner. But we are also looking at how that would be handled if we would exceed that capacity. So that's being worked on. We're also reaching out. We have a lot of connections with a lot of the large companies and vendors that have a lot of useful pieces of information and technical things that we can use to do this. We're also working very hard, as they mentioned, at getting more and more information out to the public. So that's a general overall. The only thing that I would say, which everyone always says, is really we've got to do this, continue and double down on this social, or as Kathy says, physical distancing. So if you know of folks that for some reason still don't get that, please encourage them to do that. We just have to make that happen. And for the most part, West Virginia is doing very well at that, but there are still some occasional areas where that could really be improved. So that's all I have to say right now as an update.
There we go. Learn how to do the technology here. I'm looking at a few questions that are coming in, and I'll start with some of those, and then help others. Please do send in thoughts that you've got, and we can kind of address them as we go. There's the first one that is, I think, from Jonathan Lilly here, talking about the fact that we have plenty of patients that have underlying chronic conditions, all the things that are actually putting us as very high risk for this disease if it enters our population significantly. So heart disease, diabetes, obesity, that routine care of those folks is really important so that we don't have decompensation of health on the routine things that are going on. And so I think that he's kind of raising that question of reality that not all of these things can be cared for on telehealth, and that many folks, especially who are elderly, can really only do audio. And so is there a role for, what's the role for treatment on the phone, on the video, on in the office? And I think it's a great question, because I think you were absolutely right on target, Jonathan, about, you know, sustaining people's health through this is really critical. So I think, you know, it is not elective to not do good care of critical issues that people will quickly decompensate otherwise. So certainly as much as one can, it is, you know, one can do it by telehealth, and that's been rapidly expanded through a variety of things. So you know, and that can be done not only through a audio video, but it can be audio only. The phone is fine. But you're absolutely right. There are situations and conditions that you need to see someone. And so I think it's thinking about how do you make that the safest possible activity in your office. And I know folks have done that different ways. I'd like to think it'd be interesting if we had an opportunity to kind of open up dialogue here about how people are doing that and how you're managing that with each other. So I know some places are doing all of their kind of chronic care, higher risk in you know, the morning, and then other activities that if you've got respiratory symptoms, et cetera, at night, and then doing the cleaning there. There are some places that are dividing out between different offices, who you see in which office. There's lots of kind of creative ways to make it happen. But it is a critical piece of how it's, and I'd love to hear from you all what really are the ways that make that work for you. Do you want to open up and do a couple other questions first, and then we can, what's best there? Anyone looking into how to make sure diabetics on insulin and other patients who must give medications themselves or other family members via injection have adequate supplies of alcohol wipes? An article in Kaiser. Yeah, we're increasingly seeing shortages in a variety of healthcare supplies. And it's really, this is a challenging. Medications, wipes is an interesting one. I had not heard that one yet. You know, I think these are the things we need to hear from you in the field to know what's short, and how you're, what you're seeing with that. Cause we have to continue these other needs that people have. So I agree. We've got to really have a track on that. So thank you for raising that one. Can we open up a little bit more fully? We can actually hear some of the things people are coming up with, their issues.
Sure. If you want to unmute for a second, if anybody has a question, we have some other questions that were submitted, but I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that particular point that was just raised.
There we go.
Anyone have any comments on that? And then I'll remute everyone.
with how you're doing chronic care and if you're seeing shortages in particular areas. You can unmute yourself if you're trying to talk.
Yeah, this is John Wade. We have very few PPEs. We have 4 gowns for all of our folks, and I'm an older physician, so we've been advised not to see anybody in the office because we cannot guarantee or even help stop our employees from getting disease, particularly on the people that don't know they have it, and that's a major problem. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is Dr. Kearns in Charleston. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We've had 50 positives, and it's paralleled the national data very much. 85% non-hospitalized outpatients doing okay. 15% hospitalizations. 5% of those end up in the ICU. 2% death. We've had the one death here. So it's fortunate we do not see an excess of comorbidity complications that we were so afraid of that Dr. Lilly raised. I was afraid we'd have a lot more hospitalizations, small sample size, but it's a start.
Yeah, we are seeing a fair number. I mean, starting to get hospitalizations, certainly. We are starting to see deaths. And it is a, we you know, if you look at the Kaiser study, we actually have the population that is the highest risk in the country because of our elderly, percent of population is elderly. And because of our even younger population with that chronic disease. So I think, you know, we have a high risk. That is why we really are being so adamant about being very aggressive about the prevention measures. It's also, you know, really, even if you're not always seeing all of those patients, how do you stay in contact with them to kind of just do that monitoring, checking in, making sure they're doing okay? You know, if people have respiratory disease, especially following those that have got underlying chronic diseases, so that you can early on make sure they link into care to see you if they need you or if they need to go to an ER, et cetera. So it's an important area to think about. How are folks staying in touch with their high risk patients and helping their high risk patients just kind of continue to get the services they need for primary care?
So I'll talk. I'm Dr. Lauren Miller, Medical Director for Robert C. Byrd in Lewisburg, West Virginia. So what we're doing is we're looking at what we have scheduled across all of our providers, asking them to look at their schedules and prioritize who needs to be seen in office that wouldn't be able to be accomplished via telephone. We're calling them and allowing them to keep their appointments via telemedicine if they feel that they're stable, then asking them to call in so that way it's patient initiated. If something seems urgent or emergent and they don't have any COVID-19 symptoms, we screen them for fever at the door. Then in full PPE that sadly is being reused, we have one provider a day amongst a multi-provider practice. And actually rotations 2 weeks on being that provider to see our urgent patients. So the one thing is don't always get your usual physician, but we're trying to have sort of what we call hot zones and clean zones that really conserve PPE.
That's really interesting, really creative. And I like the way that you're thinking about in terms of cohorting your well patients and a physician that is kind of the same time. So you're not having everybody see everybody at once and intermingle.
Correct. Yeah.
Really. And then
we do have our mobile health unit in the parking lot. So if you're someone who has symptoms, even if they don't meet criteria, they may be having a COPD exacerbation, depending on they might still necessarily get a swab. But I have two residents and myself in hazmat suits who are there taking their vitals, listening to them, but we stay outside all day so that we're not potentially making our staff ill. They even bring us lunch and we have a porta potty in the parking lot. So
Interesting. And so that using that outdoor space, now got weather that we can do that in. I know we had a call of the day with some of our pediatricians, and we were hearing about how they were still doing the well child visit kind of discussions on telehealth and on the phone, and kind of going through all of that counseling and checking in and understanding, but then bringing in the child for the immunizations, for instance, because that's such a critical thing. We don't need measles on top of COVID. So bringing in their kids for immunization, some of them were doing that in the car. Some of them were, at special times a day, only very limited, who came in, and limiting who they saw and the exposures they would have had in the clinic. So yeah, the same kind of ideas, using that outdoor space, limiting how many providers are seeing patients at once, all those things. That's really neat. Other ideas?
Well, I think we'll mute everyone again, and we do have a couple questions that have come in the chat, and this is a little recurrent theme. They express their gratitude to Dr. Slemp and Dr. Marsh for what they're doing. The healthcare professionals facing stressors of COVID-19 will be established on a statewide basis. I'm aware there are individual hospitals that provide some assistance and support. However, there are medical legal issues which are likely an obstacle to the development of such a broader statewide peer support system. Is there any potential for declarations from the governor to provide medical legal protections to those providing peer-to-peer support, thereby enhancing the likelihood of broader statewide peer-to-peer support system?
This is a great area, and actually maybe we need to open it up to Dr. Hall to speak to a little bit. We've been talking about having a town hall in which we could speak a little more broadly about this. I think this is a really stressful time to be a healthcare provider. I mean, it was stressful already. We already have an enormous burnout. My background was family practice. My husband does family practice. We know that burnout every day and the challenges and the issues that folks were dealing with were difficult. And then now we throw this on top of it, our practices are changing. So I think how we sustain ourselves is really important, because if we don't do that, we can't help anybody else. And we have both a duty to serve, and we have a duty to be protected with that, and the need to support each other. There's nobody that can understand it fully as opposed to someone that is that peer-to-peer piece. Dr. Hall, can we unmute you and have you talk a little bit about some of the strategy you think about with this and the importance of this area, and then some of the things at a statewide level that would be helpful to help support it and engage it? Brad, are you there?
Can you hear me okay?
There you are. Great.
Yes, somebody had me on mute. Thank you for taking the time. And in my work relative to the PHP and aware of what's going on in some other states, the value of peer-to-peer support is pretty much invaluable. Physicians, nurses are very resilient. And in these kind of events, when there's just another whole layer of stressors, they are in need of peer-to-peer support, not necessarily going straight to a therapist or a psychiatrist. And the way we're all spread out, the ability to talk to somebody who understands, doctor to doctor or nurse to nurse, is invaluable. And just a little bit of hope and understanding really goes a long way for this population, but it's very difficult for them to pick up the 1,000-pound telephone and make that first call. A lot of EAP models, you'll see they do it for their employees, and it can start with a peer-to-peer conversation and then be more or less triaged. On a more statewide level, with doctors being spread out away from institutions that may have access to that, I think there's going to be a bigger and bigger need for the ability for a provider to call and just talk to somebody about what's going on with them, what their stressor is, and just vent and somewhat of a pressure relief to a colleague who they know understands. And that would be a starting point. And I think we would find that in general, there's not as many calls as what people would think there are, but the ones that do call, the service is invaluable. And there could be a system set up that would lead to next steps if needed. Unfortunately, in my work, I see a lot of downstream consequences related to mental illness and substance use, but we can usually look back and see where certain stressors of life related to just things all humans go through, work-life balance, illness, loss of a loved one, COVID-19 events become a trigger. And it creates a breaking point that leads to downstream consequences. So I think the service would be invaluable. I'm just not sure we can set it up without some type of protection to that initial level of contact that probably is the most important piece that's needed. So it's invaluable service. And I know they've tried to do it in some other states, and they ran into this issue that in order to expand more than just the local hospital or group, it's difficult, but much needed.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to think through with you what that might look like and how we could set something up. I mean, I think that's a great idea. I'd be interested in other people's thoughts with that and what it would look like for you.
Anyone have any comments about that particular issue that Dr. Hall was just speaking to?
I think we all have to recognize our own humanity in all of this, and that we are we have both incredible strength and resilience within ourselves, and we also have that need to make sure that we all understand it's good to be able to reach out and connect and link and deal with those stresses that are there, because they are very real. Find those ways to do that. Maybe we can follow up, Brad, and have some more conversation about what they might look like across the state.
I would be happy to. I've talked to a couple other individuals in the state who would also be supportive, and we're even looking past the initial peer-to-peer contact and how do you develop the other layers that would need be in place to support that first call if needed.
Okay. Excellent. We have another question that came in that we will get it. And I apologize, I had to step out for a second. There were multiple questions submitted regarding management in nursing homes. Did you get to that? Nationwide, there's, the mass testing and evacuation to different approaches with nursing home. So I didn't know if you could maybe speak to a little bit about nursing home. We've certainly seen that in West Virginia with a couple cases. But if you want to speak to the nursing home management piece.
Well, there's a couple of angles to take with this one. There is certainly, this is a high-risk population in a nursing home. We saw what happened in Washington State in the center there. We've had an outbreak in a nursing home in Mon County, which we had, I think, 21 residents and 8 staff that turned out to be positive. And as we went in and looked, we've had several were symptomatic, but there were a few that were actually asymptomatic that we identified. And so it's just a whole different world. So then we've had other nursing homes, we've had individual cases, and we go and we actually look around that case and find that no one else was positive. Or we've had workers in nursing homes who have been COVID positives. But, again, it turned out that it wasn't spread further in the nursing home. And they probably obtained it in the community. So I think there's a couple different issues. There's both, how do we manage it when it occurs in a nursing home? But even more importantly is how do we take the measures to really bolster the prevention of either it entering this one extent, but recognize that it probably will at some point. It's too easy to come in to assume it's not going to do that. And so how do we put in place the measures that really minimize spread within the facility so that when it comes, it's not going to be extensive. So that's both that screening of who comes in and out, but that's even that, you know, because with asymptomatic spread, you can have that get by pretty easily. You know, there is the whole use of personal protective equipment, infection control, and cleaning. There is the whole area of, do you have staff kind of cohorted with patients so that you're not doing the same staff going all the way through the facility? You know, and do you have the same, what kind of group activities do you do? Is there a lot of intermingling of those, or is it focused, and how do you put distancing? So I think there's just lots of efforts that could be put to really strengthen, and folks are being really creative how to do this, to strengthen the protections in the nursing home, to minimize spread if and when it does come in. There's also, and I think this is driving the issue of trying to be careful about not bringing it in, which I understand. And there's been a lot of focus on nursing homes wanting to have a negative test before someone comes in to the facility. It is not a perfect screening to have a negative. That doesn't necessarily perfectly mean that they couldn't still develop the disease down the road. And that's why I speak to the other pieces there. I would not be overly reassured by that piece. So there's been a lot of discussion. We've had a lot of problems, and actually CMS does have a recommendation around testing now that just came out, that they do talk about using a test before re-entering into the facility. The issue, that's what I hear today, I've heard that, I've not seen it. The issue that we're seeing, of course, is requiring this is backing up patients in the hospital. And so you've got the person who had their hip surgery or their because they fell and broke and they had an emergency hip surgery or their congestive heart failure was treated, nothing to do with COVID, but, or people even just were seen in the emergency room for UTI symptoms, and the facility not wanting to take them back. And so this has been a real issue, and it's backing up folks in the hospital, and it's been a challenge. There's been a lot of discussion around this, and there are some strategies that are being looked at in terms of, and we need to operationalize them soon. Are there areas of the hospital where they can stay for a little while where we've got some extra space? But that's not going to last longer term when we begin to have more, if we have more patients in the facility. There's also then the concept, and I think the current thing has been that there may be a cleared out area that kind of could be a step down facility for a little while folks get there. It's clear they don't develop illness, they're stable, and then transfer them back more to their home nursing home or facility with that. So, and maybe do some testing from there. So I think there's, others are actually active in that area more than I am. But those are kind of the concepts that are in the works and looking at how to do that. I'm guessing that you are seeing this issue pretty significantly in the community level.
So I think Dr. Marsh may have joined. I unmuted everyone for just a second. Dr. Marsh, are you able to get on with us?
Dr. Marsh.
Clay? Are you muted?
Maybe we're having mute problems. Well, maybe we're having challenges. I know he sends his best regards and he apologizes and thanks Dr. Ramsey. Is that you, Dr. Marsh? Well, I think, you know, in the essence of time and being respectful of everyone's time, we can, maybe just pivot to, unless there's any last questions. There's been great questions in the chat box. We'll do our best to follow up, or Dr. Slim, to follow up with those questions. But I think, Dr. Slim can kind of take us home and round us out.
Hey, Dr. Costello.
Yes.
I see Dr. Young's joined us.
Oh, excellent. Please, Dr. Young, the West Virginia State Medical Amazing President, as well as the dedicated health officer of Kanawha County. Would love to hear You have many of your members on, Dr. Young.
Well, hi, it's great to connect with everybody. I know that these are very challenging times, and this is the best way that we can connect right now. And I want to say that State Medical has done an excellent job. Danny Scalise has really tried to keep us all informed and all together, making sure that we have people who are involved, like John Wall, who I have borrowed back to public health to do double duty. He's done an amazing job. And just to see Kathy Slim, thank you, Dr. Slim, thank you so much for being on the call and
Actually, I was glad my computer was causing problems today because I was listening.
Okay. let me cover a couple of things before we close out, and then I'll let Lisa look and see if there's anything else that we need to kind of cover question-wise that we can speak to a little bit. But a couple of just hot topics and some current thoughts on those to kind of keep you in the loop with it and get any thoughts or feedback you have. PPE is obviously one of the most important pieces and that we've been lots of focus around. As you know, we have received some from federal supplies. Those we have actually distributed, and we've had 100 and just a look at N95 masks, there's been 100 and some thousand that have been out into communities. I know you all are sourcing things yourself anywhere you can. There's a big effort through the Guard. They are actually searching to purchase supplies literally around the globe. And so there are purchases that the state has made that we are waiting to get those in. We are shooting bigger than smaller just to try to get more and more. And so as soon as those come in, we will distribute. So I think one strategy, of course, is to do this, to source as much as we can and then get that out. The other strategy I think that is evolving, and I think I'm going to share a little bit of this now, but there'll be more details because it's just getting worked out. It's been something we've been kind of able to begin to shape into a concept. So the other strategy is that there are abilities to decontaminate PPE and reuse it. And there are a variety of methodologies, the ones that I'm hearing and others that have this expertise more than I, but that are most effective are UV light and also vaporized hydrogen peroxide. And so one of the ideas has been if we could actually set up a system in which providers could save their PPE rather than discard it, but save that PPE. And then the Guard would actually come around and pick up the PPE and collect it and then take it to a place where we knew that it would be appropriately decontaminated and have some confidence in the quality of that decontamination and the effectiveness of it, both in terms of decontaminating the product, but also maintain the integrity of the mask or the other item. And then reuse that PPE. So rather than having everybody try to decontaminate their own with varied abilities and efficacies, looking at how we might do that centrally in a very controlled and verified way. So I think that's a second strategy that we're trying to kind of think outside the box, be creative to maximize these issues, both in terms of sourcing as much as we can on one side and saying how can we maximize ability to reuse safely so that people really have supplies in place. So there's more to come on that, but you might want to think about holding on to the stuff that you would normally discard, and then we'll get you more information on what that might look like as that evolves. Open to ideas and thoughts with that. The other piece that I'll just share is we've had a lot of questions around clinical guidance and treatment of the disease. And so one of the things that Lisa has done nicely has been she has she's kind of convened folks from the three tertiary medical centers and several other intensivists and ID docs and infection control entities, folks to kind of come up with some common clinical guidance. In the absence of true clinical guidelines developed nationally, We felt like it'd be, people have said it'd be helpful to have something that looks at how do we recommend treating mild disease, moderate disease, more severe disease, and giving some information and guidance on that. So we're finishing those up, I think, today. Close. Okay. She tells me it's soon, but over the weekend. And so we will hopefully get that out either via health alert or some other method to provide some guidance, you know, it would be guidance. It's, you know, people have to use clinical judgment and apply their own, and it's not replaced. Once down the road, there are more clinical standards and guidelines by national entities. We would certainly, you know, want to follow those, but it was to give people some starting pieces of what the current experts around the state and the current universities are using to treat, so that people in communities could all have some of that same information. And then also thinking about the resources that an individual in a smaller rural hospital might have to consult with somebody at either intensivist or a ID doc, et cetera, so that you could have that support to be able to manage locally as much as one could with that. So that is in the works and hopefully coming out soon. And we look forward to sharing it. And thanks to Lisa for helping convene some of that work.
Yes, and so I apologize. Dr. March was calling in, and then the governor called him. Dr. Slemp was also getting calls throughout the time. So they're very much in demand, and we certainly appreciate Dr. Slemp and Dr. Ramsey taking time, putting things together. There were many questions that we couldn't get to. We'll follow up with each of you and continue to look out for emails for future events and guidance that will be coming out through the Bureau and through the department. So thanks everyone again for joining. I don't know if you want to just say any final
just thoughts. Thank you for joining, and thank you for the work that you're doing, and let's stay connected moving forward.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, so.
Thank you.